This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Liz Carlisle, a fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at the University of California, Berkeley. Liz is also a PhD candidate in geography at Berkeley, holds a BA from Harvard, and is a former country singer. She previously served as a legislative correspondent for agriculture and natural resources in the office of United States Senator John Tester, an organic farmer from her home state in Montana. Liz Carlisle is here today to tell us about her book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America, published in 2015. Welcome, Liz.
Good morning, Diane.
What is the Lentil Underground?
The Lentil Underground is a movement of farmers in Montana who realized that the industrial model wasn't working, and they decided to try something different. And the normal model, the industrial model in Montana, is all about monocultural wheat, and they rotated in lentils.
What led you to find out about the Lentil Underground and write your book?
Well, I am from Montana originally, but I'm from western Montana, which is not the agricultural part of the state. My grandmother was a farmer, so that kind of got me interested. But the reason I met this particular group of people was because I was working for Senator John Tester, who is an organic farmer, and in fact, an organic lentil farmer. And I was working in the office as a legislative correspondent, so I was getting phone calls and emails from people in the state of Montana who had policy ideas, and a number of them were his fellow organic farmers. And I realized that this was a grassroots political movement and farmer science movement, and I was curious to learn more.
What are the advantages of lentils?
Lentils are a legume, which means they can fix nitrogen. So they pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere, where it's abundant, and convert it into a plant-available form, working with symbiotic bacteria. So they exude this nitrogen through their roots, and they use it themselves for fertilizer, but they also leave a residual behind for the following crop. So they're essentially a biological fertilizer, which allows us to replace synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, which, as it turns out, is the greatest component of greenhouse gas emissions in our food system.
And how about nutritionally?
Lentils, of course, are very high in protein, so that comes from the nitrogen. And they're also really high in fiber, folate. They have greater antioxidant capacity than blueberries. So there's a reason why people have been both growing and eating them for 10,000 years, essentially all of human agricultural history.
How did the Lentil Underground begin?
The Lentil Underground began, as I see, in the 80s, although really it has an older heritage with sort of grain pools and agrarian resistance in Montana. But I start the story with a character named David Oyen, who was 27 when he came back to his family farm in Conrad, Montana, 1976. And he didn't want to go the industrial model. And in fact, he couldn't because his farm was only 280 acres. This was when Earl Butz was saying, get big or get out. And it wasn't big enough for get big, and he was too stubborn for get out. So he went with the third option, which was go organic. Let's see if we can do this without any chemical inputs and develop a new market, not the commodity market, but relationship-based markets with organic consumers, people who were eaters, who cared about the same things, reducing chemicals, more nutrition, healthier rural economies.
How are the steps to organic farming in Montana different than for vegetable farms on the coast?
That is an excellent question. Organic farming in Montana mostly happens at, say, a 1,000-acre to 10,000-acre scale, whereas vegetable farming on the coast, usually you're under 100 acres, and a lot of times it's hand scale, especially for harvest. It's mechanized scale in Montana, so that's different in terms of the processes on the farm. And then the other thing is the market is a completely different story because you don't have an urban area right there to take your harvest to the farmer's market or develop a CSA. So it's about developing these, you know, cooperative structures for marketing to people who are going to be at some distance.
How did the farmer-owned company Timeless Seeds get started?
Well, that was David Oyen and three of his farmer friends in 1987. They started growing legumes and alternative crops because it was good for their land. So they chose their crop rotation based on what would be good for the soil. But they didn't have anybody to sell them to. There was nobody purchasing organic lentils from Montana farmers at that time. So they realized, you know, we're going to need to develop a business to market our crops. And they started by marketing cover crops to other farmers. And they realized that wasn't going to be lucrative enough to support their families. And so then they started marketing edible legumes, lentils. And so they formed this business essentially to support the conversion of their farms to more ecologically appropriate crops, and then extend that to more of their friends. And now there's about 20 to 30 farmers who grow for Timeless Seeds in any given season.
What kind of people are the farmers who grow for Timeless Seeds and decided to go organic?
Well, one of the fun things about researching and writing this book is that it's hard to characterize them as one sort of person. There's such diversity among the growers of Timeless Seeds. I think that the common characteristic is this desire to get out of the commodity trap. And so there's a certain independent spirit, but at the same time, there's a real community spirit. So it was interesting for me researching this book. There's a big strain of kind of rugged individualism in the mythology of the West and of Montana. And people kind of started there with this, I'm going to buck corporate agribusiness. But where they came around to was this appreciation of interdependence, because they couldn't buck corporate agribusiness alone. They had to work together. So I guess it's that sort of combination of traits that really characterizes the growers of Timeless Seeds. Whether they identify as hippies or libertarians. So it's not the typical political mix.
What were some of the reasons Montana farmers decided to move from conventional farming to organic?
David made the transition out of conviction, I think, out of a sense that we can't continue on this industrial chemical path. He had read Silent Spring. He had been involved in anti-Vietnam activity, understood the connection between the military-industrial complex and the agro-industrial complex. And it's the same chemicals, in fact, that were manufactured for wartime purposes in World War II and repurposed to drive this industrial, chemically-dependent agriculture. So for David and for some of his peers, I think it was about not putting these poisons into the earth and regenerating the land that they felt they had some responsibility to. He was a religious studies major. He studied a lot of indigenous American thinking about stewardship and relationship to land and the rest of creation. But for a lot of people in the 80s, that was the farm crisis time. It was an economic necessity to move into some other kind of farming or lose the farm altogether. There were a lot of years when fertilizer prices were so high and grain prices were so low that even if you were doing everything right and by the book as a farmer, you were losing money. So people were also, from an economic perspective, looking for a way out.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Liz Carlisle, author of the book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What were some of the problems in finding funding to grow organic?
Well, one of the big problems was that banks didn't take this seriously at all at the beginning of the movement. The main character of this book, the founding farmer and president of Timeless Seeds, David Oyen, he tells the story of when they moved into their first facility off of his farm. They wanted to buy this $40,000 beat-up old elevator just to be able to package product for their first customer. And so they didn't have $40,000, these four farmers who got together. So they go into the bank and they say, we're organic farmers. We're growing organic lentils. And the bank had two questions. What is organic? And what are lentils? So they essentially crowdfunded this from the beginning. They asked family and friends to become their original shareholders. And then later on tapped into the slow money movement. So I think, you know, even at this point, now that organics is better known, still the financing often comes from people who are interested in the values.
What is the history of political farm groups in Montana, and what has been their role in making it more feasible to be an organic farmer?
You know, the history of political farm groups actually dates from long before we had an organic program or even the first organic certification. The Farmers Union has played a large role in Montana agriculture, and although they're not focused on organics per se, they have a lot in common with the organic movement in that they're interested in farmers being in control of their own destiny and healthy rural life vibrant rural life and definitely sort of anti-corporate focus. And so that group was really important as sort of the prehistory to the organic movement in Montana in developing some of the values and then also the tools. The Farmers Union, one of the main things they did was develop cooperatives. And then out of that group and out of that movement have grown other groups. And then also out of the counterculture, the 60s and 70s have grown other groups. And one of the main groups that's important in the story of the book is called the Alternative Energy Resources Organization, which began because people were concerned that there might be rampant coal and oil development in the 70s, and then has since then focused on, well, if that's the energy future we don't want, fossil fuel, what do we want? And so a focus on renewable energy and sustainable agriculture.
Let's focus a bit more on the company Timeless Seeds. Would you say more about the customers of Timeless Seeds, how they were found and who they were?
Yeah. Well, Timeless Seeds now is about a $1 million company, and they sell to natural food stores all over the country. They work mostly with regional distributors, so they have a diversified business approach as well as a diversified farming approach, rather than having one big distributor or one big customer. So they're in natural food stores. They also work with a lot of chefs, and they're working a lot with farm to school, farm to college, and farm to hospital. So those are all really interesting opportunities to connect directly to students and to patients who can really benefit from the nutrition.
Would you say more about the role that community played in the success of the Lentil Underground?
Yeah, community was essential to the success of the Lentil Underground. And actually, I think that's really at the heart of the story, is that it was a group of people who came to recognize the importance of interdependence, both in the natural world and in human community. That's what lentils are all about. In a sense, they're a rotation crop. They return nitrogen to the soil. They're part of an interdependent, complementary network of creatures. And the farmers who grew them had to work together, too, because they were doing something so different. So they were sharing knowledge. In many cases, they were sharing equipment, sharing labor. And so community has been essential to really even getting off the ground with either this movement of organic rotation farming or the company itself, Timeless Natural Food.
What are other ways that the growth of organic farming in Montana affected the local communities? How did they change?
That's a great question. You know, I think it's brought economic development. It's brought up sustainable development to small communities in Montana because people are earning a higher premium growing organic crops than they would growing conventional crops. Some people are coming home to small communities in Montana who've gone away to college. And, you know, that's a wonderful thing, too. You know, when David came back to his farm in 1976, most parents would have been happier for their kids to leave, really. The idea was if you got an education, why would you come back to the farm? What is there here? We're just kind of a backwater. And now I think because young people are so excited about organic farming and really value what you can do as a steward of the land and a nourisher of your community, there's a number of kids who come back to these communities after getting a college education and start CSAs and write blogs about what they're doing. Jacob and Courtney Cogill come to mind. They're in Power, Montana. Both Montana natives went to college, have advanced degrees, and there's this vibrancy.
How effective has the Lentil Underground been so far in changing the food system overall?
You know, I think the Lentil Underground has been effective in making change where they are on a certain limited scale. And I think other movements have been effective in making change where they are on a certain limited scale. And what I hope will happen through telling stories like this, why I'm inspired to tell stories like this, is that we can connect up to each other and that we'll understand that if we have all of these small movements in particular places to change agriculture so that it's regenerative for the land and regenerative for the community, and we share our knowledge and we come together in coalitions to change policy, that we can, in fact, change the food system. But it's going to be, as one of the booklets said for Arrow, many little hammers rather than one big hammer.
What are the implications of a locavore movement for Montana organic farmers?
That's a great question that you bring up, the locavore movement. Local food systems have been sort of the way people think about sustainable agriculture for the past maybe decade or so. And I think there's a lot of good in that because it encourages people to know their farmer and understand the relationships in their food system. But we also need to think beyond local. And this is important in the case of Montana farmers because most of their markets are outside of the 100-mile radius that we usually think of in terms of food shed thinking. And they live in an area without very many people and a low-income area. And they really need those allies from Seattle and the Bay Area and New York. And in fact, I've been sharing a lot. There was a study that came out of Carnegie Mellon in 2007 that looked at the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the American diet. And only 4% of those emissions came from transportation to final point of sale, what we quantify as food miles. Most of those emissions come from what happens on the farm. And most of that has to do with synthetic nitrogen fertilizer. So you're better off supporting a lentil farmer, a legume farmer, who may be at some distance than conventionally fertilized produce nearer to home, if it's about the greenhouse gas footprint.
Would you also speak about the problem of cost for low-income people in buying organic lentils?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm so excited about farm to school, because that brings healthy, nutritious food to everyone. I love that model. I love the farm to hospital model as well. Absolutely everybody should have access to this food that is not chemically treated, that's nutritious. We can all garden if we have access to land, but many of us don't have access to time. Many low-income people are working two or three jobs, so I just really support expansion of farm-to-school programs.
To what extent have government programs overall helped or hurt organic farmers?
You know, that's another great question, because in the Farm Bill now, we still have sort of like the lion's share of the Farm Bill, which supports the commodity system and that structure of subsidies. It's changing a little bit. It's moving towards insurance. And then we have all these smaller programs that are really helping organics. So policy kind of cuts both ways. And definitely we need to continue to be attentive to the Farm Bill and to other policies that affect farmers, too. Healthcare policy affects farmers enormously. Because since we have this employer-based system for the most part, farmers are outside of all that, and it's this huge risk. And so taking the risk of being in an alternative market on top of that risk of the healthcare issue can be a lot. So that's a policy that people often don't think of when they think about organic farming, but it came up a lot in my research when I asked people, you know, what's one of your biggest issues, one of your biggest sources of risk? So if we're able to expand our public health care system, I think we'll see a lot more people who feel more comfortable becoming organic farmers.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
I hope people take hope away from this book and inspiration and energy for this type of organizing in their own community. I hope it connects people in different places who are working on changing the food system. And, of course, I hope it gets people excited about lentils.
And what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
You can get together with your neighbors and change the world.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Liz.
Thank you so much, Diane.
You are just listening to Liz Carlisle, author of Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America, published in 2015 by Gotham Books, an imprint of Penguin Group USA. For more information, check on the web at lentilunderground.com. Again, that's lentilunderground.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Power at 90.3 FM and kexp.org.